It is Thursday, August 6, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Malaysia says more parts of MH370 have been found on Reunion Island. The Japanese city of Hiroshima commemorates the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombing.
So every year this time, there's a commemoration ceremony. There are a number of documentaries aired on TV that remind people of the horrors of the war.
And country music star Reba McEntire says goodbye to her husband. It's all ahead. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak said early Thursday the piece of an aircraft wing found last week on the French island of Reunion in the Indian Ocean is that of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, which disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing 17 months ago.
Today, 515 days since the plane disappeared, it is with a very heavy heart that I must tell you that an international team of experts have conclusively confirmed that the aircraft debris found on Reunion Island is indeed from MH370.
The flapperon, a barnacle-covered fragment of a wing that washed ashore on Reunion, was flown to France for analysis. And so far, investigators have stopped short of linking it to the missing flight, only saying there is a very strong presumption that it is part of the Boeing 777 debris that has eluded international efforts thus far. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, whose country has taken the lead in the international effort to find the plane's debris on the Indian Ocean, says the search must go on.
And we owe it to the hundreds of millions of people who use our skies. We owe it to the 24 million Australians who use our skies. We owe it to them to try to ensure that air travel is as safe as it possibly can be, to try to get to the bottom of this terrible mystery. And that's why the search must go on. But what we have found in the Western Indian Ocean does seem to indicate that the plane did come down more or less where we thought it did, and it suggests that for the first time we might be a little bit closer to solving this baffling mystery.
In addition to Reunion, debris sites could include the Seychelles, Madagascar, Eastern Africa, and Southern Australia. Aviation analyst Jeffrey Thomas in Australia tells VOA's Victor Beatty there's no doubt in his mind this wing fragment is part of the ill-fated Malaysian jetliner.
The Malaysian Prime Minister and his department have been closely liaising with their inspectors in France who are looking at the piece, also with Boeing, and they've had confirmation from their own people that it is definitely from MH370. While we understand one identification plate is missing because it was bonded on and 12-plus months in the sea has caused it to separate, there are other markings on this that would identify it from MH370, and I think that the Malaysians want to get out there first with this announcement, particularly with their relationship with the relatives of those who have been lost. So I think they've done the right thing.
Malaysian Airlines calls it a major breakthrough, but there are still an awful lot of questions, and of course we have no bodies, no black box. What happens now?
Look, indeed, it's a major breakthrough in the sense that it's proof positive that it is in the Southern Indian Ocean. Drift modelling done by various organisations and also the University of Western Australia over 12 months ago predicted that debris from the search area where we are now looking would turn up in Reunion Island, Madagascar, East Africa at around about this time. So the arrival of this is absolutely consistent with all the drift modelling that's been done. This gives the search momentum. This gives the searchers who are halfway through the area of highest probability, they've got another year to go if they have to search at all, it gives them momentum that they are looking in the right place. This aeroplane is in the Southern Indian Ocean. It's not in Russia. It's not in Afghanistan. It's in the ocean.
The big question is, why does a flight that originated in Kuala Lumpur en route to Beijing end up so far away off course?
We have to find the black boxes. We have to find the actual main body of wreckage. This may take quite some time more simply to find the wreckage, let alone recover the black boxes, then take the information from them and understand, or try and understand, what happened on that aeroplane 515 days ago.
Will the black box still be operational? Would there still be information there? And that is such a vast ocean. How likely is it ever to be found?
First of all, the black boxes, the digital flight data recorder, there are two black boxes. The digital flight data recorder records the heartbeat of the aeroplane, all the systems. There's over 80 to 100 parameters approximately. That will tell them what was going on the aeroplane. The cockpit voice recorder, the other black box, is on a two-hour loop. So you only get the last 2 hours of conversation of the flight. Now, many people hypothesize in this particular event, all the passengers had passed away from hypoxia and probably the flight crew as well. And therefore, on the cockpit voice recorder, there'll be nothing whatsoever. That's one theory. It may well be it's different, but there's a possibility on the cockpit voice recorder there'll be nothing at all.
That's aviation analyst Jeffrey Thomas. Well, Malaysia's announcement that debris found off a French island in the Indian Ocean belongs to MH370 has done little to answer the persistent questions of Chinese families of those on board the flight. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Chinese family members and relatives of those on board missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 say the announcement made by Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak has only fueled their anger and frustration. One of their biggest concerns and questions is why the announcement was made, even when some have yet to give a final confirmation that the debris indeed belongs to MH370. Steve Wong calls the announcement irresponsible. His mother was on board the Beijing-bound flight that went missing more than 500 days ago.
If you don't get 100%, even if it is 99.9%, it is just still might be. But I don't know why Najib wants to give such kind of conclusion in such a hurry.
Another family member that spoke with VOA on condition of anonymity says the decision to make a hurried announcement before France issued a final conclusion is not only irresponsible, but raises questions about Malaysia's true intentions. Family members say they are not in denial, but that they owe it to their loved ones to not just declare them lost without 100% certainty about what happened to the flight. In his announcement, Malaysia's prime minister said an international team of experts had conclusively confirmed that the debris belonged to the missing plane. However, prosecutors in France, where the debris is being examined, say there is a very strong presumption that the portion of a wing that was found belongs to the plane. Chinese family members say that both French investigators and Boeing, the maker of the aircraft, should confirm that the flaperon belongs to MH370. On Thursday, officials couched their comments about the development. Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop confirmed that the search for the missing plane would continue, adding that once the French team confirms the debris belongs to the plane, a further analysis of currents, drifts, and winds would begin. China's Foreign Ministry expressed its sorrow and sympathy for the families of those on board and urged Malaysia to make good on its commitment to fully investigate the crash. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. Wang says Malaysia needs to do more to explain the developments to the relatives of those on board and give full consideration to them and the sufferings they have been through. Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappeared on March 8th of last year and is believed to have gone down in the Indian Ocean nearly 4,000 kilometers away from where the debris was found on Reunion Island. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, MH370 is again trending after this news. A lot of people reacting to the Malaysian Prime Minister's comments, hopeful that this will bring an end, as I said earlier, 17 months that people have been waiting for answers and the families have been waiting. So they're hoping that this brings some closure for them. We have a couple of important anniversaries today. Here in the U.S., it's the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. This was an act signed by President Lyndon Johnson to guarantee that people could not be discriminated against on the basis of race when voting. So we see hashtag Voting Rights Act, VRA50, those kind of hashtags are trending. We also see hashtag Restore VRA. The Supreme Court of the United States struck down some key provisions in the Voting Rights Act a few years ago. So people are using this anniversary to try to correct that and get the act restored. We also saw Hillary Clinton, who, of course, is running for president, had a hashtag, #MyFirstVote, asking her followers, tell us about when you had your first voting experience. A lot of people sharing nice stories, some people saying, my first vote's going to be for you, and then backfiring a bit, some people saying, my first vote won't be for you. So, but a lot of talk on social media about this Voting Rights Act. We're going to be covering it on our social media at facebook.com/voiceofamerica. We're going to have some TV packages today on the Voting Rights Act and the anniversary, so we encourage everybody to check those out. It's also the 70th anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. Of course, the U.S. dropped a bomb on Hiroshima 3 days later on Nagasaki during World War II, which led to the start of the end of the war. A lot of people talking about, in the guise of the Iran deal and nuclear weapons, this is something that we have to remember to end all nuclear weapons around the world and any kind of chance of this being done again. People sharing photos of victims and photos of the bombing, and I know you're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the show.
Yes, we will.
And then finally, the Ashes 2015. Now, this is the Test cricket series between England and Australia. Interestingly, this is actually trending in the U.S., and as we were talking about just before I came on, it's not a huge sport here in the U.S., but no. More of an international sport. So it seems to be maybe some trending, shifting trends in the U.S., maybe more people starting to follow cricket. But trending worldwide and here in the U.S. goes from early July through the end of August, and so people, a lot of trash talking and saying, oh, well, Australia's not going to win this time and England, you know, is going to win or vice versa. Interestingly, I read that the series is about tied. I think Australia has 32 wins, England has 31. So it's an even matchup, and one that's going to continue through the end of the month.
Yes, interesting. So cricket fans, take note. Thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope have confirmed the discovery of the closest known Earth-like exoplanet. The planet, called HD 219134b, was found crossing in front of a star only 21 light-years away in the constellation Cassiopeia. The Spitzer observations also reveal that the exoplanet, which orbits too close to its star to support life, is about 1.5 times bigger than Earth. HD 219134b was first discovered by astronomers using the HARPS North instrument on the 3.6-meter Galileo National Telescope located in the Canary Islands. Astronomers say that since HD 219134b is so close to Earth, the exoplanet would be an ideal subject for follow-up research. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about the divorce of a well-known country music star. As we heard earlier, today marks the 70th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb by an American B-29 bomber on Hiroshima, Japan. The attack forestalled a U.S. invasion of the Japanese home islands and helped bring an end to the Second World War 9 days later. An estimated 80,000 people were killed immediately on August 6, 1945, a death toll that would rise to about 135,000 in the days and months to follow. Today, tens of thousands of people observed a minute of silence as bells tolled at the Peace Memorial Park near the epicenter of the bombing. Hiroshima Mayor Kazumi Matsui called for a renewed effort to rid the world of nuclear weapons. He said, in order for us to live together, we need to end the use of all nuclear weapons, the ultimate in inhumane pure evil. And the moment to get this done is now. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said Japan, as the only country ever to be attacked by an atomic bomb, has a unique responsibility to create a world without nuclear weapons. He said, and that resolve translates in us proposing a new draft resolution at the United Nations in the fall about nuclear disarmament. This year's anniversary comes as Japan's debates expanding Japan's security role and restarting idle nuclear reactors shut down in the wake of the Fukushima nuclear disaster of 2011. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston of Temple University in Tokyo, who says most Japanese remain strongly opposed to all forms of nuclear energy.
They're very pacifist. They're very concerned about protecting Article 9 of the Constitution, in which Japan renounces the right to wage war and to main armed forces. So every year this time, there's a commemoration ceremony. There are a number of documentaries aired on TV that remind people of the horrors of the war. I think that earlier this year at the New York Review Conference of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Japanese delegation suggested that all the world leaders should visit Hiroshima and Nagasaki so they could better understand what's at stake. And in the midst of that, the Chinese delegation then said, well, no, we shouldn't include that because it's just a way of Japan trying to position itself as a victim of the war in which it really was an aggressor. So I think in Japan, Hiroshima is the most visited site for school children going on their excursions. You know, all over the nation every year, you know, school children, elementary, junior, and high school children will go visit sites around the country, and Hiroshima is definitely the most popular site. And so peace education and understanding about the horrors of nuclear war are strongly reinforced in the mass media by visits to the Hiroshima Peace Memorial. Indeed, in comic books, one of the most popular comic book series called Barefoot Gen is about an atomic bomb survivor and describing the horrors that he witnessed. So I think it's very difficult to grow up in Japan and not develop a strong aversion to not only nuclear weapons, but also nuclear power.
Well, that's an interesting point, because Japan has not only been the object of two atomic bombings, but also Fukushima, the nuclear meltdown in northern Japan. The Japanese have been through some terrible tragedies involving nuclear power.
And that explains why there is very strong opposition to the Abe government's plans to restart nuclear reactors perhaps later this month or next month down in Kyushu. Japan's reactors have all been offline since May 2012, and there have been no power shortages, there have been no real negative consequences, and so people are concerned that the government is rushing ahead with the nuclear restarts before they've really digested the lessons of Fukushima and before they developed, for example, evacuation plans and things along those lines in terms of developing a culture of safety in the nuclear industry that three investigations showed was totally absent and helped explain the Fukushima accident.
That's Jeff Kingston of Temple University in Tokyo. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. First, it was Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert who announced they were splitting up. Now, Reba McEntire and her husband of 26 years, Narvel Blackstock, have announced they are divorcing. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about the most recent high-profile breakup.
If you've been at a basketball game, a baseball game, a soccer game, a wedding, anywhere large groups of people get together, you have heard Salento's tune, Larry, Watch Me Whip, watch me nay-nay. Although I think if I whip in nay-nay, that might scare people.
There have been 90 million views of this video on YouTube so far and counting. And the song is currently number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100, number 2 on the R&B charts. This kid is hot. His real name is Ricky Hawk. He's 17. He's entering his senior year at his high school in Georgia. And he goes by Silento. And he was asked why you call yourself Silento. He said, because I'm less talk, I'm more action.
Now watch me whip,
kill it.
Now watch me nay nay.
Okay.
Now watch me whip, whip. Watch me nay nay.
Why me do it?
Now watch me whip,
kill it.
Watch me nay nay.
Okay.
Now watch me whip, whip. Watch me nay nay.
Can you do it?
Now watch me, ooh, watch me, watch me, ooh, watch me, watch me, ooh, watch me, watch me, ooh,
okay.
Oh, my goodness. Now, see, I think with a name like Hawk, you would probably want to keep that, because that's bad. That's like a bad name. That's like Avery Brooks.
Bad to the bone.
A man called Hawk. You know? Well, I mean, seriously, but so this is did he just, like, do this in his bedroom? He did some samples or some tracks or something?
Absolutely. He doesn't have an album. He's thinking about an EP. He believes in singles right now. That's what he said. It's all about singles, putting out singles, and this is his first attempt, and he's already won the Rap Artist of the Year Award at the Underground Interview Awards, and he's nominated at a Kids' Choice Award show for the R&B Hip Hop Song of the Year. So the guy's hot. You can't deny it. This song is already selling millions.
Well, that's the thing. 90 million views on YouTube. A lot of people are doing that, though.
Yes.
A lot of people are kind of bypassing the old school music industry, let's go to the record company thing, and they're just putting out their videos with their music on either like YouTube or SoundCloud or whatever. People are discovering him, and then the music execs go, hey, wait a minute, there's a 17-year-old in Georgia.
We've got something here. So the kid is popular right now, and he's doing very, very well and continues to do well. In fact, he's talking about going out on tour and thinking about that. He was on the BET Awards show recently, performed the song, so he's getting a lot of attention. He claims his influences are Usher, Mariah Carey, and Chris Brown.
All right. Well, that's good. You know, of course, if you want to hear this video, you can log on to YouTube. If you want to talk to Larry, send him a tweet. You can do that, VOA_music. Also, be sure to listen for his show, Border Crossings. That you can find on www.voanews.com.
And that is our show, International Edition. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Afghan Minister of Finance Ekhlil Hakimi, the U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan P. Michael McKinley, and the USAID Mission Director William Hemmink signed a Memorandum of Understanding for the New Development Partnership on August 3, 2015 in Kabul. The New Development Partnership reflects the strategic importance of the U.S.-Afghanistan relationship and recognizes a new era of development cooperation between our governments. This initiative delivers on the commitment made during Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's March visit to Washington, during which President Barack Obama pledged to support the Afghan National Unity Government's efforts to achieve its own ambitious reform agenda. Afghanistan's Minister of Finance Hakimi thanked the U.S. for its generous support with the New Development Partnership, under which the U.S. will provide up to $800 million to Afghanistan to maintain and build on the development gains made over the last 13 years. U.S. Ambassador P. Michael McKinley remarked that the New Development Partnership represents a fundamental transformation in the nature of development cooperation between our two countries. It empowers Afghan solutions to Afghan challenges by incentivizing and rewarding Afghan successes. Afghanistan continues to face difficult challenges: recovery from decades of violent conflict, the continuing threat of violent extremism, the need to provide education, health care, and basic infrastructure for millions of men, women, and children. In meeting these challenges, Afghanistan will have the continued help of its friend and ally, the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.